Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So many white guys.
So many.
So many white guys. So what?
How much whiteness? All over the place. God damn. So many white guys. So many white guys.
Welcome to So Many White Guys from WNYC Studios. Just kidding. That's not how I talk, you guys. Welcome to So Many White Guys. YQYE. It's me, Phoebe, and my producer, the white Robin Quivers, Johnny Mitch.
Hi.
That was the most urban you've ever sounded.
Hi.
Okay, boo-boos, here is the tea, the Lipton tea. Pour some honey in it or agave sugar or syrup or fucking, I was going to say polenta, but no, it's Splenda. Pour polenta into your fucking tea. Anyway, the point is, I've got a freaking double header for you today, okay? I've got two sexy-ass guests and one sexy-ass show. Two for the price of one. Two to tango. Ow.
Double trouble.
Up first, it's my buddy and friend of Tune Up Queens, John Early. Yay! Okay, so you might know John from the Netflix show The Characters, or the TBS show Such Party, or from touring the country with his stand-up, okay? That's the first guest. Can you handle that? Can you handle it? I can't hear you. Hello?
I can handle it.
Thank you. Next up, our second guest, my brother from another mother. I, of course, am talking about Baron Vaughn, who you guys heard co-host an episode of Two Dope Queens in season 2, which is very exciting. Baron once slept on my couch, and now he's in 2 Netflix shows. How many shows are you in on Netflix? None. Well, he's in 2 because he's hogging it all, okay? He's on Grace and Frankie and the reboot of Mystery Science Theater 3000. Ooh, ooh! Wait. Hold up. Joanna?
Uh-huh?
Is Netflix, like, sponsoring this podcast or whatever?
Not that I know of.
Okay, well, can you get on that? Like, that seems like an oversight.
Yeah, Phoebe, that's, like, not really my job. Because I'm just so focused on, like, getting the show made. But I can send an email to Hal, and he take care of the sponsorship stuff.
Okay, so are you going to handle it?
I'll send an email.
Joanna, you always send these emails. I don't know where they go.
Are they in your spam filter? Yeah. You should be getting my emails. They're from limpdick69 at hotmail.com. Are those getting caught in your spam?
Yes, they are. I'm going to go look up Lipdick. All right, let's get to these interviews. I'm so excited. They're two of my favorite human beings. Are you ready, Joni?
So ready.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Oh, my God. Okay, John.
Hey, Phoebs.
Bowman.
Mm-hmm.
Early.
Yeah.
I'm so happy you're here. I mean, you are just so, the energy you emanate is like, it's just infectious. I want to be around it.
Oh, man.
I live because of it. I die over it. So wonderful.
Rest in peace, Phoebe. You went too soon.
I did. Oh, my gosh. But I'm happy that you're here. And we met, I can't remember how many years ago, but it was after Creek in the Cave. We did some,
yes,
like, whatever show, and you had this bit about how you used to do, like, a Toni Collette fan site.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, my God, she's so fun and so special and so different. And then, like, now you've, like, blown up with How American Summer, the characters on Netflix, and then now the new show that you're in, Search Party for TBS, which is, like, such an amazing character comedy.
Yeah, it's so good. I think it's a hit.
It is a hit.
I think people really like it.
Yeah, it's getting like a lot of rave reviews, which I think is awesome. And you're so multi-talented. Like, you're funny. You're all these things. I loved the characters in particular because of your impression work.
Thank you.
But then you also, on the opposite end, you do, I think now, like, a legendary Britney Spears impression. Like, literally everyone loves it.
It's like, do I retire it?
I don't think you can because I'm going to have you do it right now.
No!
John, it's like literally one of my favorite things about
you're so sweet.
Like, performance-wise, not as like
Thank
a person.
You.
Like, there are
Thank you.
Better things about you than like your impressions.
I appreciate it. Yeah. I appreciate it. My Britney, people love the Britney.
Yeah.
I love the Britney. I remember doing that in high school, and like my friends never laughed.
What?
Like, I was like doing it alone in my bathroom, and then I would like debut it at like lunch, and I was like, why is no one laughing? I was like, and it's yeah. I'm so happy I held on to that because I was like, I know this is funny.
Yeah, they're just being haters.
They were.
Yeah.
I mean, I honestly think they were threatened by the accuracy.
Yeah, because you grew up in Tennessee, right?
Yeah.
And so, but what about Britney for you excites you to impersonate her? Like, you know,
well, I mean, like, vocally, I just find it so funny that like there's so much effort, and like it sucks because like she gets accused of being a bad singer,
mm-hmm.
and like she's obviously not like a super proficient live singer, but by the way, what pop stars doing full choreography are,
right.
I mean, lip syncing is just something that is done,
mm-hmm.
we accept it as, you know, it's part of the social contract of seeing a pop star, you know.
Yeah.
But like, to me, it's so funny that like she doesn't have to do what she's doing because it's not like that's her natural voice.
Right.
Like, there's no way when she's just singing alone, she's like, like, you can hear it. She's like pushing it down so hard. She's like, first, that's step one, is literally just like farting out of her throat. Like, and then after that, when the note like finally comes free, she's
yeah.
still clamping down it. Like, like, she's like sick and like
yeah.
pissed off, like, and like it's so funny to me because
yeah.
you can hear the effort, and it's like, what would happen if she just like didn't do that? Like, what would her
right.
real voice be? But anyway, so
yeah.
that's what I find so funny about her vocally. But then, of course, I'm totally like all of us who kind of grew up loving her unironically,
mm-hmm.
and then watched her, you know, as we came of age, we watched her come of age, and like be really, really tortured, and
mm-hmm.
like, you know, she wanted to get out of this position that she did not choose at all. And
yeah.
like so many women who are like basically sexualized by like the entertainment industry, they're then blamed for being whores. It's like,
yeah.
it makes no sense.
No, but it is true because it's like, I do think that a lot of times, like, we just forgive men for bad behavior.
Yeah.
We don't for women.
Yeah. And how can you even be mad at Britney? First of all, like, what bad behavior? It's literally that she was, you know, scantily clad.
She looked great.
She looked fucking great.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
You can curse on this.
Okay, you bleep it out.
No, we leave it in. It's raw.
Ooh,
baby.
God, I love public radio. Why am I horny all of a sudden? Yeah, whatever. Britney.
Yeah, and what's your, like, go-to when you want to impersonate her? Like, what's the song that you love to do the most?
Well, why don't you choose?
Well, I think my favorite Britney song, she has so many good songs. Like, people forget that.
Yeah,
and you go back through her catalog and you're like, this is, like, great pop
and
music.
And some of her recent songs.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there are, like, a few songs on each of these new albums that are really good.
Yeah. I'm a Slave for You is one of my favorite Britney ones.
Are you asking me to sing it?
Yeah.
Okay. How old was she when she shot that video?
I think she was like early 20s.
That's horrifying. I remember like still being kind of on the border sexuality wise when that video was out.
Oh,
like being
okay.
like being like, I'm bi.
Yeah.
For like a week.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, and people were like, who do you think is hot? And I'd be like, Britney Spears. Because like that's what everyone was saying.
Yeah.
And that video to me would like prove it to me that I thought she was hot. But it's literally just because it's like sweat and skin and
yeah.
like, you know, and like choreography.
Yeah, it's like my vagina moves to that a little bit.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, straight. Like all
yeah,
of that.
I know.
So great.
It's so sexy.
Okay,
here we go. I know I may be young, but I've got feelings too. And I need to do what I feel like doing. So let me go. and just listen. Oh, people look at me like I'm a little girl. Everything can be okay to the world. Oh, I say a little girl, don't step to the cloud. I'm just trying to end the eye. What I love, yeah. Get it, get it, get it, oh, get it, get it, get it, oh, get it, get it, get it, get it. Thank you.
That was so good.
It was good, right?
That
it
was really good. Thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you, Phoebe.
I'm sure you're going to be like, you're going to hit 40. You're going to be like, if someone asks me to fucking do this impression again, you're going to like lose it.
I know, but I do, like, I have been doing it so much recently. I'm like, what is the next step for that impression?
Right.
And I think it's like, I think I need a grand piano, and I think I do every time.
Oh, I love that.
But I'm not playing the piano. That's the trick.
I love that. That's fantastic. Okay, so let's, just in case people aren't super familiar with you, let's do like the John Early story.
Okay, great.
So you grew up in Tennessee.
Grew up in Tennessee.
And both of your parents are ministers.
They're ordained ministers, not anymore. I mean, they still are ordained. So they can still, they still do weddings, funerals, like guest preach all the time. But they don't have like full-time churches anymore.
What's it like to grow up in a household where like religion is pretty prominent?
Well, I was really lucky to have minister parents who were very like theological. They like went to divinity school. That's where they met. They went to Vanderbilt Divinity School. It's very sweet.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
It's really cute.
Yeah.
And you know, like Al Gore went there. There was like, it was in the 70s. And Vanderbilt is like one of the more liberal southern schools. So like they were really like, my parents are really smart. And like there wasn't ever any sense of, there wasn't any evangelizing going on. I never had, they never put any pressure on me to like believe anything. I mean, they took me to church. They liked that it was like a community for me, like that I could make friends there. And there were like other adults who cared about me there, you know. But like the second I started like coming into myself and being like, I don't believe. Like you're just like singing hymns, sitting down, sharing the joys and concerns, you know. So anyway, they were very, very cool about, like the second I started kind of questioning it, they like admired it. They're like, oh, they're like, good for you. So I was really, really lucky in that regard.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And they're very, you know, because they went to school for it, they're like always kind of talking about things critically. They're never talking about it in like a manipulative way. They're not like, they just weren't abusive.
Yeah.
Thank God.
That's great. So I want to read a quote from an interview you did with Maxim about growing up around religion. You said, I think as a gay kid that you're inherently more interior, protected by your introspection. And you said that you're able to protect yourself from your exposure to Christianity that way. So can you just like talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that is the gift, I think, of being when you wake up into the world and you're like, well, something's off. Like I don't have the same set of desires that I'm supposed to have from what I'm seeing in popular culture and the adults in my life. And then you just kind of as a protective measure, you just kind of go inward. And it's, though it can be very isolating, though it can take years to come out of that or to learn how to like be among people. I think it does provide gay people like a really like, I think they're really, you know, all really marginalized people, I feel like, can have like a stronger sense of introspection because of it. And like there were, though my congregation was really liberal, though my parents were really liberal, I was going to like Christian camps every now and then. And like you would occasionally run into kind of some very conservative Christian people. And I think I just knew very early on that I didn't trust something like outside of me and I could only really trust myself. And so I was like, I just kind of stayed inside and it really helped. It really, really helped.
Yeah.
I wasn't very conscious of what I was doing, but I was like, I'm just going to stay inside and I'll come out like later.
Yeah. You know? And so you grew up in Tennessee and then when did you move to New York?
When I was 18.
Oh, me too. Yeah. For college.
Yeah. Where'd you go?
Pratt Institute.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Where'd you go to school?
I went to NYU.
Oh, yeah. See, I tried to get into NYU and they were like, LOL, your grades.
For writing?
Yeah. Right. I was a slacker in high school. I think I had like a C- average because I just honestly did not give a shit.
Yeah.
And they were just like,
no.
We're NYU. Yeah. We can't.
Yeah. I went to the drama program at NYU.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And what was that like? Was it just you're surrounded by a lot of people who are maybe trying too hard, or like what is the okay.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of people just in general. Like, it's a very big program. Mm-hmm. And also it's like you're 18. So like everyone literally like 3 months prior to like the first day of school was doing like their high school production of Sweeney Todd. You know what I mean? With like a nude head mic like taped to their forehead and like parents like sobbing and clapping for them. So like there is like people come into the NYU program or to any like program where you're 18 years old and suddenly they're thrust into these like hyper serious programs. Like I went to the Atlantic Theater Company, which was very serious. It's like David Mamet's theater school, and like it's very much about like discipline and doing the work and analyzing the text before you even start to try to act, you know. And I had like really, really smart teachers who I just basically the biggest thing I took away was just like the opportunity for 3.5 years to just talk about art. I feel like training wise, it's really hard for someone to actually change in like an acting program.
Yeah.
You know?
And so I know you're acting now, but then at some point you made the transition to stand up.
Yes. Yeah.
So what inspired you? I know you've like talked about in the past that like you've idolized women in comedy.
Yeah.
And that's been an influence to you. So what specifically about women in comedy like influenced you and what made you decide that, oh, I want to get into stand-up?
Well, the women thing, I mean, I just think it's a classic kind of gay thing of like you're just not really included in masculinity. And so women, when you see women being funny on television, it's like, I'm sorry, what? It's like, it seems so punk rock. Like it just seems so like rebellious. Mm-hmm. For like a woman to be like wild on TV. And so I think they, and also women are like your protectors. Like women were my friends when I was young. Like my girlfriends were the ones who like made me feel safe. So like I obviously, why would I have gone to television and why would I have sought men out to like relate to or like idolize, you know? So like I absolutely just only was interested in, kind of still am, only I'm only interested in funny women. I'm like learning more and more that like some men are funny. But I always forget who I think is funny. When, when people ask me what men I like, I'm like, oh no.
Yeah. So if you live in New York, you know that you have your show, Showgasm. I mean, unfortunately,
over.
I know because you're moving to LA, you're a trader, it's fine.
Okay, well, I have to for a job. Okay?
I mean, I get it, but it's also like you could just, you know, said no.
Sure.
But you're in the drag world, and I feel like a lot of your drag is character-based, which I think is really cool because I think a lot of people who aren't familiar with the drag world only really know of it being, like, really fishy or, like, trying to be the most exaggerated version of a woman. And I think what's great about drag is that, like, any other art form, it's constantly evolving, and there's all these there's goth drag, and there's, like, all this kind of stuff that's really cool and happening. And so I'm wondering, like, when you started to enter that space, where were you coming at it from?
Well, I always wanted to, like, just from a, like, an SNL perspective, I always, like, the women I loved on SNL, like, those characters that they played, dressing up as a woman was always just that. It was, like, me doing a Sherry O'Terry character, you know? So it was always, to me, more about just, like, these are the comedic characters I want to play, and a lot of them happen to be women.
Yeah, I really like that. I know when you talked about how sometimes it's harder, like, gay audiences are harder than non-gay audiences.
Yeah.
But what, like, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think gay people don't know how to make art about themselves. I think, like, I think gay people like to, understandably, they like to watch, like me, they like to watch women being funny. Or they like to watch art about women. And then as soon as they get the opportunity to put themselves front and center, it either becomes, like, immediately, like, sexual. Because that's the other thing, too, is I think gay guys, when there's a gay entertainer on stage, suddenly there's sexuality involved, which is, like, foreign. Like, that's what I'm learning, is, like, gay men like women, female performers, because there's no sexual energy, like potentially like dangerous sexual energy or like to like muddy it. It's like such a clear relationship. It's like, I'm not going to look at you in a sexual way. Most men look at you in a sexual way and objectify you. I'm looking at you. I'm worshiping you. I'm like, I respect you for your mind and your talent, you know? And there's something very clarifying about that. And then I think when there's like a gay performer on stage for gay audiences, suddenly they're like, but wait, am I supposed to be attracted to you? Or am I supposed to, normally I laugh at people who don't make me hard. You know, yeah, so like there's, yeah, yeah. I'm not saying I make anyone hard,
I
Phoebe.
Mean, you
okay,
do.
I'm a cow.
You are not. You are stunning. You are blonde. You have a great personality. I can't even
thank
deal.
You. Thank you. Shush, shush.
Okay.
But no, I do think that people just are still trying to figure that out. Mm-hmm. And I'm still trying to figure it out. But sometimes, like if I'm a guest on like a gay show and it's like full of gay people, mm-hmm. I feel this weird, like, something like shuts off and I feel this like weird coldness or like, and then there's also like super cool, like kind of like normcore gay guys who I feel like have never liked me or my comedy.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Could all be in my head.
No, I mean, there's probably some, I mean, I feel the same way, like all black audiences sometimes. There's just like,
yeah,
you feel pressure to like be really good because you're amongst people who look like you.
Yeah.
And so there's just this, you know, I'm sure anyone who's not in a marginalized group, like just a hetero straight yeah. guy, like doesn't have that sort of like, they don't have to be, oh, well, I'm in a room full of white people.
Right,
like,
right. What do
huh?
I do? What
yeah. Now? Where I'm yeah. like, oh, I don't want people to feel that I'm like not black enough or I'm
right.
this or I'm that or,
right.
you know, all that sort of stuff. That's like really, yeah, it's difficult. And yeah, I think the work that you're doing is important.
Thank
I think
you.
It's necessary. And yeah, I cannot wait to see what you do next. I'm
Phoebe.
Like, and I'm like,
it's mutual, honey.
I know. I'm sad that you're moving to LA, but I will come visit you.
I'm going to be here all the time, baby. I
you
can't
say that now, but you're not.
Now you listen up.
All right. Well, thank you so much for popping in. We could have just talked for hours.
I know.
And
I could
hours.
Go on.
Yeah.
Do you want to go to the Cozy on 12th Street and Broadway and get a bread bowl? Let's do it.
I love Cozy. Oh, my God. It's so cute. Okay. Well,
thanks,
thank you
Phoebe.
So much. I love you.
Love you.
Okay, bye.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met in telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
John Early, so good. Phoebes? Oh. Okay, so Phoebe's not here. She was supposed to be here 10 minutes ago, and we've only got 20 minutes left in the studio, so guess old Joni's just going to have to move this along herself. Great interview with John Early. So fun. So funny. Next up, we've got Baron Vaughn. I guess I'm going to be Phoebe for a second. Hi! Are you ready for some sausage? We've got my brother from another mother, Baron Vaughn! So put your hands together for this sexy piece of man meat. YQI! Do I sound like Phoebe? I don't, this is why I'm not the host.
Well, I am so happy you're here. This is literally a reunion.
Is it a reunion? Okay.
It is. It's a totes a reunion because, yeah, because you did Two Dope Queens season 2.
That's true, yeah.
Which was amazing.
2DQs, yeah.
Yes, and now you're on So Many White Guys season 2.
That's right, doing it.
This is thank you for being here.
That's right. When things get to season 2, I'm second on the list.
No, but I'm excited that you're back in town because mm-hmm. you're based out of L.A. And why are you here? Why are you gracing lovely New York with your presence?
Well, I'm here for the Mystery Science Theater 3000 premiere. Yeah.
Okay. Know. Full disclosure.
Okay. You can disclose.
I've never seen that show.
That's fine. A lot of people haven't.
So what is it about?
It was hugely popular in the late 80s, early 90s. It was on the beginning of Comedy Central, like early Comedy Central, before it was Comedy Central even. So the premise of it is a man is kidnapped in space, of mm-hmm. course, and he's held prisoner on a spaceship by mad scientists who force him to watch bad movies.
Oh, that's cute.
They're trying to drive him insane. And he's alone, so he makes friends out of spare parts, and he makes two robot friends that watch the movies with him, and he hangs out with them.
Oh, that's kind of real. You know?
It's very prescient. Yeah. Because that's definitely where we're headed as a society.
We're so headed there.
Yeah. And now, you know, because now we can just hang out with Siri if we want. How are you, Siri? I'm fine. That's what she usually says.
So we're reunited. This is amazing.
And it feels so good. Yeah.
Yes. You were on season 2 of Two Dope Queens. And we talked about, you know, your relationship status.
My relationship status. And right.
And I'm Soups Minaj.
Yeah, Soups Minaj.
And you are polyamorous.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Is that still your status?
Well, let me put it this way. You can be an atheist and still be with somebody who's a believer.
Okay, so you could be polyamorous. I think what you're saying is you could be polyamorous and then be in a monogs relationship.
Because look, and this is a matter of debate because the community of polyamorous people can't actually agree on this. Mm. It's sort of like any label, there is no one definition for it. Mm-hmm. And anybody that falls under a label will say, well, I am not like this other person who falls under this label, so you can't. We're not a monolith, right? We're not all the same. So the thing about poly people, that's the nickname, you know, because you gotta save time when you're dating so many people. You don't have time to say amorous. I gotta get to my other date. This is hi, I'm Joey Polyamorous. How you doing over here? So yeah, I got a wife. We got a girlfriend. Don't worry about it. That's an impersonation of a polyamorous person from Bensonhurst. Anyway, so it's like an idea, you know, it's a way of thinking of things. But some people think that you aren't polyamorous unless you're practicing it, and I'm not practicing it. That doesn't mean that I've stopped thinking the way that I'm thinking. I've just made a certain decision for myself right now. And my decision is to be with a person who wants to be monogamous.
Yeah. What made you want to be polyamorous?
Well,
because you didn't always. You used to be a monogamous, like strictly monogamous relationship.
Yeah, but you know, I've been thinking about these things for a really long time. So before we met, yeah, I was in a monogamous relationship, but before that, I had been thinking about what polyamory was. I just didn't know what it was called.
Oh,
because I didn't know it existed. It was just ideas I had that I had no idea that there are so many books written about it. There's whole communities. There's workshops. There's all this language that people have developed for it that I didn't have. I just understood that it was ridiculous to ask everyone to do one thing.
Right.
That's not a knock on monogamy. It's a knock on culturally enforced monogamy. That everyone is expected to be the same way. And if you're not, something's wrong with you, as opposed to something is wrong with the box everyone's trying to fit into.
Right.
That's the way that I always looked at it.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like I had questions about why that was the main form of a relationship, why everyone expects so much out of it. And that's the biggest thing for me is people expect so much out of it, out of one person. Mm. Not to say that that's necessarily wrong, but most of the time it leads to a murder. So
okay, well, that's – no, I think this is, like, really cool to, like, talk about it because I think the more people –
we haven't really,
like,
ever talked about it that much.
Right, and because we've, like, butted heads in the past.
Yeah, because
– but it's good that we can, like, talk about it now.
But the reason is because – the reason we butted heads is because I was on my high horse.
Yeah.
It's honestly what
it
is.
Oh, my gosh. It feels so good to hear you, like, admit your flaws.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was, for me to be right.
I was on a superiority complex in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But now I'm 10 years older. Yeah. So I'm calmer.
Yeah.
But definitely back then, I was like really sensitive about it. And anybody who challenged me, I was like, you haven't thought about it the way. Like, it's just kind of like, but that's different than listening.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I want to switch gears real quick.
Okay.
Because you're on a wonderful show on Netflix. You have so many shows coming out. So you're on another show for Netflix called Grace and Frankie. And it is season 3, 4?
Season 3 is coming out, yes.
Which is very exciting. Congratulations.
Why, thank you.
For the people who don't know, what character do you play on the show?
The name of my character is Bud, which is an abbreviation for Nwabudike, which is actually, I believe, a Nigerian name. But Bud for short, because I'm adopted by white people. So they named me something that they can't say all that much.
That's like what Madonna does.
Oh, is it?
I'm sure.
Complex name, but I'm going to call you this for short.
Yeah.
So I seem cool.
So Lily Tomlin plays your adopted mom.
Yes, Lily Tomlin and Sam Waterston, native New Yorker himself as well. So, yeah, it's – if you haven't seen the show, two seasons of it are streaming on Netflix right now, and the third season comes out March 24th, which they just announced. So coming out soon, yeah.
Yeah.
And then also, the premise of the show is two women, played by Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda, who are actually good friends and have been for like 40 years or something like that, have been married for 40 years and then find out that their husbands have been having an affair with each other for 20. And then their husbands announce that they're gay and leave them for each other. And it kind of blows their lives up.
Yeah.
It's about starting over when you've been around.
And so the cast is mostly white. You're the only person of color on the show.
Yeah.
And I have recently been I've been getting invited to more and more events. I'm not like trying to brag. It's just like what happens when you're
okay, Braggy Smith.
Where you're in this industry for a while, people start being like, "Oh, I think I vaguely know who you are. You should come to this thing with people way more famous than you who won't talk to you." And you're like, "Cool." So I've been doing that, and I've just been like noticing that I'm usually tend to be the only person of color, and so I've been feeling like I'm done being the only person of color in white spaces.
Yes.
But on a show like this, which is dealing with not only like queerness, but also starting over and older people, I do feel like there is some complexity to it. And it's not just a kind of typical show about white people. But do you ever feel like, I'm the only person of color on the show. And that is, you know, do you have any feelings about that or is it not really?
Oh, I have a lot of feelings about that.
Yeah.
I am the only person of color on the show. And I feel like sometimes, like, you know, they pussyfoot around around the issue. Because he is culturally white because he was raised by white people.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? These are the questions that I ask as an actor playing the role because I have to make it make sense to myself. So he is a black person that was raised by affluent white people in an affluent neighborhood. But does that mean that the police know that? Does that mean that when he walks into a corner store that anyone know, oh, his shirt's tucked in, I think I know what this guy is about.
Right.
So it's like those are the questions. And I think about like stuff like when he went to college, where did he go? You know, did he have an identity crisis when he was in college? Because when you're black, people will treat you like you're black. And if you have never really had to entertain that in your life as a reality, it might create some sort of confusion. But these are the things that haven't been explored. And I don't even know if this is the show that would be able to explore that.
Right.
Because it is, after all, a sitcom.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about these characters. It's not called Bud. So I respect that decision. But, you know, every now and then, of course, I feel it.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like, well, it's just me. It's just me here. And so I look at it like first, obviously, I'm happy to be involved and I'm doing what I do and I get to play with Lily Tomlin and all these great actors who I've loved for a long time, you know. But every now and then I feel like, okay, so, you know, this is not a place where a lot of issues I would like to be able to explore in a TV show can be explored.
Yeah. So you mentioned Lily, which is great because, you know, knowing you, she's one of your comedy influences, which is amazing for several reasons. One, because she's a genius, but also it's really nice to hear a male comedian say that he's been influenced by a woman, because it's always like Mel Brooks or like Larry David or like Robert Townsend. Like, those are great, but it's like there have been so many women who have like done really funny shit and no one's ever influenced by it.
That's true. But let's talk about Mel Brooks and Robert Townsend real quick. No, I'm joking.
So what about her appealed to you? Because I, knowing you as well as I do, I feel like you are very in touch with the masculine and the feminine side of yourself, which is why I think why you are as equally influenced by women and men creatively.
I mean, I was raised by two women, my mom and my grandmother, right? So in a way, and I guess I look at it in a sort of a way that, you know, we live in a man's world. We live in a patriarchy. And I feel like women have all the emotional understanding. So when I have looked for comedy that is expressing complex emotionality, it's usually women that are doing that comedy. And so Lily Tomlin, to me, well, I used to watch Laugh-In when I was a kid, which they used to play on Nick at Night, like reruns.
Yeah.
And so I noticed that this was the only person, you know, who usually had a solo bit. Like most of Laugh-In was sketches. Mm-hmm. But when it was Lily Tomlin, it was like her as one character and one person. And she could hold the whole audience with that one character. And I was like, what? How is that? How do you do that? So her approach to doing characters and what it is she looked for and that she thought was funny about a person was really influential on me. So Ernestine was one of her characters mm-hmm. that she did, was a telephone operator. And on set one day, I told her that how much I loved Ernestine and it was very important to me. And then she did the snort, which is part of Ernestine's laugh.
Yeah.
And I almost cried. I was like, oh. I learned in that moment, like, uh-oh, this was really important.
Yes, that's very funny. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you.
And then Michael McDonald came out and sang.
Oh, Lily Tomlin, what else you gonna do?
So anyway,
I Michael McDonald, if you're listening to this, can you please do a duet with Baron Vaughn doing you? Because that would be brilliant.
Oh yeah. So many white guys. You got a show to me.
All right.
Okay, so people who don't know you as well as I do, mm-hmm. You actually started out doing stand-up 12, 13 years ago?
15.
15 years ago. So would you say that Lily is kind of like the reason that you got into stand-up?
A lot of those people when I was a kid, all the different comedy that I was watching, I was taking it in, but I didn't know that stand-up was a thing that I could actually do until I was in college. Mm-hmm. And then so
you went to BU.
I went to Boston University. Yeah. That's right. So I went to an open mic finally, and then I saw comedians I'd never heard of killing it. Mm. And I was like, oh, okay. So you can actually be really good, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that you grew up in Nevada, Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cray because you never meet anyone
from Vegas.
Yes.
Well, you know, I was born in a small town in New Mexico, and then we moved to Vegas when I was probably seven or eight, something like that.
And you and your grandma?
Me and my mom and my grandmother, yeah.
Yeah.
I think my grandmother was already there. My mom and I came to join. Mm. And so it was me and her for a while. Then my grandmother, I called her JJ. She moved in at some point.
Well, so what is that like to grow up? Because I've only been once and I mm-hmm. went for like a bachelorette weekend. So, you know, it was very – it's like, let's get some sushi and go see strippers. So it was very much like a – kind of like movie heightened version of what Las Vegas is and not like actual reality.
Yeah, now think about the indie film of what Las Vegas is like.
It's like Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah, and that's what I grew up in.
Yeah.
Ghost Dog, but with casinos.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting place, you know, and my childhood there was very latchkey. You know, I was mm-hmm. I was running around a lot, you know, because mom was working. And she was like, take care of yourself from 3 to 5. I'm like, cool. Can I get a key? Let me get a key. Find the arcades.
So your childhood was kind of like a lot of you like watching TV and sort of raising yourself a little bit?
Yeah, or babysitting myself, mm-hmm. you know? And because I watched a lot of comedy. Mm-hmm. Watched a lot of movies, a lot of TV. So I was kind of taking all these things in mm-hmm. all the time. And yeah, so I mean that's that kind of being in my head, entertaining myself sort of thing is the kind of the genesis of what turned me into a comic.
Yeah. And so because if you guys don't know, having a conversation with Baron is like you have to be on your toes.
Really?
I don't know. It's like playing tennis with Roger Federer. There's just something where it's like you cannot just sleep and like you I don't think someone could just have a boring small talk conversation with you. I don't think that would ever happen. And so you're very quick to me. So were you like a nerd growing up? Were you just reading a lot of books? Like what were you like as a kid?
Well, thank you for that compliment. I think that's what that was.
No, it is. It's like you got to bring like your A conversation with you, which okay. I think is great.
Yeah, I mean, I never liked the word nerd. It wasn't a word that I really heard used until I was like in high school. And really, it was only in movies. Like, I don't remember anyone at high school saying it. So I hated the word nerd. I didn't ever take it as a definition for myself until later in life, where I look back and I go, oh, I clearly was a nerd, but I was like a lonely nerd. So it was like,
no, because no, okay, I think okay. I was a lonely nerd too.
Yeah, because like I liked what I was in. Here's the thing about being a nerd. The best thing about being a nerd is when you meet other nerds that like the thing that you like, because then you have someone to share it with, okay? I was interested in things that no other kids around me really liked.
Like, you were trying to talk about laughing, and they were like, what?
Absolutely. Yeah, like, yeah, hey, you guys see the latest episode of Patty Duke? Sammy Davis Jr. was on it. You know what that means? We're on TV now. What is that, man? Oh, man, they walk alike. They talk alike. But I liked, I mean, like, because also, like, Robert Townsend, you mentioned Robert Townsend, and that was somebody who was a big influence on me. So I continued to follow his career. I was watching as much comedy, anything that I thought was funny.
Yeah.
And we had cable when I was young. So I could watch HBO and I could watch Def Comedy Jam very, very softly. So as to not alert my mother.
Yeah.
That I was watching Martin run, tell.
Oh, that special is, it's amazing, but it's like, yo, you cannot watch that with your parent like 100 feet near you.
I randomly, when I was in high school, Mark Curry had he had to hang with Mr. Cooper, had an HBO special that I watched. And I don't remember, I was like 14 or something, and somehow I was like at this thing where Mark Curry was there. And suddenly I'm standing next to him. And he's there with his, I don't know if it's his girlfriend or wife or whatever. And I said to him, hey, man, I watched your HBO special. It was really funny. And she was like, your parents let you watch that? That's what she said. And I said, they didn't know. And he was like, ha ha, yeah, and gave me a shake. And then that was the only conversation I ever had with him.
That's cute.
But I just remember her being like, how did your parents? And I'm like, they didn't know. That was the key to my childhood. Yeah.
No, it's cool. I like that. And I like that you embrace, because I like things that people don't necessarily like, but I lean into it super hard.
Mm. I think that the definition of cool is the I don't care sort of vibe.
Mm.
It's defensive. It's a wall. When you like something, you actually are being vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because you're telling people something about yourself. If you never like anything, then no one will ever know what you're about.
Mm.
And that's the definition of being cool.
That's food for thought, babies. Now, I want to talk about another project that you're working on.
Okay.
Documentary for Fusion.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of childhood.
Which is very exciting. I've been with you throughout this whole process, sort of. So I've been like on the phone with you being like, oh, my God. But you recently tracked down your birth father.
Yes, my biological father.
Yes. And that was the subject of your documentary, correct?
Yeah.
And so what inspired you to be like, let me figure out this part of my past?
Well, you know, earlier when I said about, you know, how we used to butt heads about the polyamory discussion, and I said I was on my high horse, and you're like amazed that I could admit that. These are the things that I have been working on the last couple years. I have a very complex relationship with my own masculinity because I never had a model of how to be. I think that's what most boys' experience of being a man is taught to them by their father. That's one of the first things a father can do is say, a man is this, son.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of ape that. You know, a lot of guys try to be like their dad.
Yeah.
So been working on that and working on this part of myself that I never really thought about because people would say, you know, do you miss it? Do you miss him? And I always used to say, you can't miss something that you never had. There is no like part of me that's missing. I'm just, it's never been there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm whole as I am. However, that doesn't mean that I didn't have questions, especially because what it is that happened to my mom around my birth, the events around my birth, I have never been told. I've never known because it was hurtful to her. It was very hard for her. And they didn't want to tell me because she would have to kind of relive what was hard. Plus, I was a kid, and they'll be like, he doesn't understand. He won't understand. Mm-hmm. And then I got older and older, and it was like, he still won't understand. And I got older and older, and it was just, they're not telling me anything.
Yeah.
It's, we talked about the past so little, I didn't even know we weren't talking about the past. I didn't even know you could ask questions about what happened before you were there.
Yeah.
That anybody ever wanted to talk about it. So that's why I set out on that crazy journey.
But were you ever anxious about doing like a documentary? Because, I mean, and filming this whole process, like there's so much of that you can't control because it involves another person and you don't know how involved he's going to want to be in the documentary. So were you ever kind of anxious about like, maybe this should not be a documentary and something maybe extremely private first and then, or were you just kind of like, I'm just going to go for it and just...
Well, yes. I mean, the whole way I had a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. I mean, I decided to do this documentary to give myself an excuse to even do this in the first place.
Oh, okay.
Because maybe I wouldn't have tried to track him down. Mm-hmm. But now that there is a network who's just like, when are you going to do that thing? I was like, oh, I guess I gotta deliver something. Yeah. So I had to go through with it. But of course, at every step, I'm like, what? Maybe this is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. What if he's dead? What if he doesn't want to be in this thing? What if it's going to make my mom go crazy? Like all those things mm-hmm. were happening as I was thinking them and feeling them as I was going along. And my documentary director, who was asking me, how do you feel like every single moment?
Yeah.
And so I was just in it, you know, just trying to be present. But yeah, I mean, a lot of those things came up in the process, you know, especially once I knew he was around mm-hmm. and especially once we talked, then it was like he wasn't a concept anymore. He was a person. He was another person. And then I started being like, well, what if that person doesn't want to be involved in this? And you know, I can hurt that person's feelings. Like suddenly I started being concerned about that, you know. But in the end, it's all good. Like, everybody should watch a documentary. It's called Fatherless. It's going to be on Fusion. When? They haven't told me yet. The future's great. Nobody tells anybody anything.
Yeah. And so having watched your performance and your stand-up ever since I've known you, I feel like you talk about – it just feels more personal in a way. Like you talk about money stuff. Mm-hmm. You talk about, you know, being polyamorous. You've talked about therapy, mm-hmm. which I think is great. And, you know, I'm all about self-help and you're all about therapy. So how do you feel like your evolution or like understanding yourself as a Black man has informed your comedy, or how has comedy informed your understanding yourself as a Black man?
It's like I looked to Black men on television to be my father figures. Mm. So ostensibly, I looked to Eddie Murphy and Pryor and, you know, the Wayneses and Robert Townsend and, you know, Martin and Bernie Mac and Chappelle and Chris Rock as father figures and modeled myself in a way after them. So I ended up in the family business in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But with that comes it gets really tricky because it's also part of the unholy union of art and entertainment mm-hmm. because what is good to you and what sells aren't necessarily the same thing. And when you're in an industry that is based on selling and people say you need to be something that sells,
yeah,
it can be very confusing because you're going, but I'm me. Can't we figure out how to get this out there? Mm-hmm. And so I was very confused in a lot of different ways of who it was I was supposed to be on stage or what was expected of me, and ashamed in a way of what was true to me and what I actually had been through. So I was ashamed to report it or to talk about it in a way because I just didn't feel like anybody would understand, which is usually why people become comedians, because we have felt so misunderstood in our lives that we go, no, I'm going to get on a stage every night and explain myself to people that do not know who I am for years and years. That's how misunderstood I am. Because I'm going to go be understood. That's what I'm going to do. So I've just gotten better at saying this is where I am. This is how I feel. This is what I'm dealing with because I have to accept it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what else is there?
Yeah. Okay, we got to get out of here. Let's close with something like fun and joyful. Like, what is like your happy place, or like when's the last time you laugh really hard, or what's a musician that you're super into right now that you want everyone else to get? Because I'm obsessed with someone new right now. This woman, Gavin Turek.
Oh, yeah.
She's amazing.
I've heard the stuff.
She's
great.
So great.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't fight it, mm-hmm. don't fight it. Yeah, it's a good stuff.
Yeah.
There's a dude I met, actually was a fan of his, and then he was in L.A. opening for, what's her name, that British woman?
Adele.
Yeah. Aluna George.
Oh.
Have you heard Aluna George?
No.
She's really interesting. But this guy was opening for her, and I had tweeted his name because I said he was one of my favorites. His name's Xavier Omar. Mm. And he, I think he lives outside of Atlanta. He has a song called Blind Man that was my jam of 2016.
Ooh.
And it's a fantastic song. He's a great singer.
Cool. Well, I'm going to go listen to both of those people on Spotify or Apple Music or Google Play because, you know, I like them all.
Tidal, Pandora.
Yep. But I always enjoy our conversations. I think I always learn something every time we talk. And I wish we could keep talking for hours and hours, but...
But you can call me later and we can do that.
Yeah, we can do that. FaceTime audio, baby. It's so crisp. It's so crisp.
It's super crisp.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much and good luck with all three of your shows.
Why, thank you.
That's incredible. You're having a banner year.
Hey, it's like I'm Phoebe Robinson or something.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Bye.
Bye. You know what? I gotta say, I think I like those two mofos.
Yeah, but it's like twice as much work, so maybe never again.
Oh, it's two first. Oh, well, wouldn't it be a threesies?
Because it's generally...
Baron Vaughn and me, threesies.
Oh, then I would say that you just did a menage a trois.
Yeah. You know what, Joni? I just did, like, my second menage a trois.
Your second?
Let's talk about that later. Have you ever done a threesies?
I think my microphone just broke. It's so weird.
Oh, it broke, but I can hear you, like,
yeah,
perfectly.
So weird. Let's get to credits.
Okay, was it two
Since
guys?
My microphone is broken.
Two guys, a girl, and a pizza place?
I do like to go to a pizza place. My microphone is broken, so I think you should.
Was it
go
you
to
and two
credits.
Gals?
I think it's time for the credits.
That is a yes, you guys. She got it, and it was clam on clam on clam. It was full on clam chowder. Manchester by the sea. The So Many White Guys team includes Rachel Neal, Joanna Solotaroff, Jim Poyant, Paula Schumann, Isaac Jones, Matt Boynton, Jeremy Bloom, and Joe Plord. Our theme song was written by a white dude and sung by a bunch of other white dudes. So we've doubled up on videos on the WNYC Studio Facebook page this week. Head on over to see me and John Early before this hot sausage moves to the City of Angels. I know I'm so sad about it. And also, see Baron Vaughn sing me a song about our black excellence. Don't forget that you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Dope Queen Faves. YQYE.
Killed it. So, you know what? Yesterday, mm-hmm. International Women's Day.
What did you do to celebrate?
Oh, you know, watch The Craft. No, I tried to set some good feminist intentions. And,
ooh.
You know, yeah, and I'm just trying to be, like, more thoughtful about how I'm spending my time and energy.
I like that.
Yeah.
So that means, like, you're bumping up the masturbation?
International Women's Day in my pants.